Hi, this is Aaron from Gangland Wire. You're going to want to join me and Gary Jenkins for the 2018 Mob Summit in Las Vegas. That's right, folks. Las Vegas, baby. We're going to be there June 15th, 16th, and 17th. Three crime-filled days with author Frank Culotta. Gary Jenkins is going to be there as well, speaking about his app, talking about his movie, sharing his book, Leaving Vegas. And then Larry Henry of the Mafia Chronicles is going to be there as well, and many, many more. We're spending Friday evening mixing with the mob at the Plaza Hotel. Saturday from 9 to 1, we're in panel discussions about the mob. Saturday night, we're going to be rubbing elbows at the Mob Museum. And it continues Sunday from 9 to 1 p.m. at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, baby. It's the 2018 Mob Summit. Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the Classic Old Ice House building, back into the Classic Old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, folks, tonight we have the second of a two-part episode with our newly acquired friend, confidant, contact, former Marion, Illinois, the maximum security Marion, Illinois Federal Penitentiary Correctional Officer, and we just call him David. David, it's great to have you back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
And folks, that's not his real name, but that's close enough for government work, as we used to say in the biz. David, you spent 23 years, and your whole entire career was at Marion, wasn't it?
Yes, my whole Federal Bureau of Prisons career was at USP Marion, and it was a supermax prison for most of the time that I was there.
I'm a little bit curious. I didn't really talk about this before your training, you know, like you go into the Army, you go into basic training, you go into the police department or the FBI or another federal agency. They have training academies. I think the federal academies, of course, Quantico, there's one down in Alabama for DEA and ATF. Did you have a training academy for the correctional officer experience?
We had a three-week course is what we had, and it was that, oh, I can't think of the name off the top of my head. We called it Glenco.
Oh, yeah.
It's Glenco, and then they train a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's where the FBI, I mean, the ATF and the DEA, I couldn't think of it, the name of it when we were talking. Yeah, Glenco. So the correctional officers go down there, too.
Yeah, they have almost everybody there except, say, the FBI. I even seen the Army had people there. Almost everything in law enforcement's done there. We had half the place was Border Patrol agents, so we had all kinds of folks there.
Now, when you came out and you were assigned, you're assigned as a, you know, like a policeman comes on, you're a street policeman, or an agent comes on, they're kind of a, what they call a street agent. In the penitentiary system, then within the system, say at Merriam, did you have a commensurate kind of like a detective unit that did investigations, and did you have a SWAT team or a response team of some kind for really bad situations?
Oh, yeah, we had everything like you're talking about. We had the SIS, Special Investigative Supervisor, and that would be equivalent of a detective. You had the street cops, that would be some guy like me, that would, protect the scene, provide evidence, write up statements. But then we'd call in the SIS, and he might collect actual physical evidence, dust for prints. And, of course, they could always call in the FBI for or the occasional murder that we had, or escape attempt, or that kind of thing. What they're going to want to prosecute it. And then, of course, we had disturbance control team, which was supposed to take care of riots. And not only did they take care of riots that would be at our prison, but they would take care of riots at other federal institutions around us. So within a certain distance, I don't know what that distance was, they might be deployed to another institution to help put down a riot. And then we had the SORT team, which is Special Operations Response Team, and they're kind of the SWAT team of the Bureau. They have snipers with high-powered rifles. Everybody knows how to use an AR-15. Well, no. With them, it was an M16. They trained with gas all the time, less than lethal munitions. They were the people that if I was taken hostage, the SWAT team was supposed to be the people that would save my life. So they trained continuously. And I tried to get one of those fellas to do an interview for me, but I can't get any of my former coworkers to talk. They won't do it. They either feel that they don't want to give out any information to help anybody, or they're afraid of being prosecuted or something.
Were you ever taken hostage?
No, I wasn't. We have had individuals that I met that told me all about when they were taken hostage, and it didn't sound like the kind of situation I'd ever want to experience. One fellow was taken hostage for 2 hours in Baker Unit prior to my being there. He was gone for years. He was off on a medical something or other for 10 years, and then he came back, and I got to meet him then, and he was the most nervous individual I've ever had to deal with that worked for us. If you walked up behind him and snapped your fingers, he might punch you in the face.
Wow.
He was just a fellow that you didn't.
Maybe
yeah, he was always worrying.
A little post-traumatic stress disorder there. Well, and being that Marion is a supermax, I'm looking here, even at just their Wikipedia page, there were a couple of correctional officers that were murdered there back October 22nd of 1983. It says Klutz and Hoffman were killed in separate incidents only hours apart.
There was one murdered before that in the 1960s that nobody ever talked about. A fellow was stabbed to death in, I don't remember, Dog or Easy, and dragged down the range dead and stuffed into a closet. Mm. So there was that guy, and then a guy named Silverstein, which everybody has heard of. I even went to Disneyland, and the guy that was checking out my luggage to get into Disneyland, I recognized his technique. And I said, "You're ex-BOP, aren't you?" He looked at me and said, "How do you know?" And I showed him my ID, my retired ID, and then we had a little chat. First words out of his mouth when I said I was from Marion was, "Oh, you must know that Silverstein guy." It's like, no, I never met him. He was taken away. But he killed a guy named Merle Klutz, whose family I've met. And then just a few hours later, a guy named Fountain killed a guy named Robert Hoffman. And that was in what's now our special housing unit, or at the time it was called the control unit, or H unit, down on Baker Range. And it was rumored, or actually it ain't rumored, a guy that was there that day told me right here, and he said, "I'm standing where the pool of blood was for our two officers." And then it was very fresh in everybody's mind when I first started there, and they always wanted to impress upon me that if you screw up, we may not be able to save you. So these are the kind of things you need to keep your eyes open for. And you talked about training for me. The real training wasn't at the academy. The real training was from them old guys who would drill into your head constantly, "Don't do this, don't do that. Be careful of this. Look for that." It was a constant thing. So the training academy kind of gave you the foundation, but the real house that you built on that foundation was the older officers that guided me through, my first couple of 3 years. Same was when I was a police officer. That academy they sent me to for 8 weeks. or 12 week. I went to a 12 week police academy. After that, it was the older cops that really got me used to being on the street.
Yeah, that's true. That's kind of how it works. What would be an example or two of things that the guys, the older guards taught you to look for that would help you anticipate any kind of trouble or maybe avoid some kind of trouble?
Let's say a member of the Aryan Brotherhood, all of a sudden, he thinks I'm a great guy. I'm just a fellow that he's happy to see. They're going to murder me.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the signs. You know, like, hey, we like you. You're a nice fella. They're trying to lull me into a false sense of, oh, they're my buddies. They wouldn't do anything to me, and then they stab you to death. One thing is, when I was a cop, I was worried about being shot dead. And I thought, wow, that would be a really terrible way to die. But in prison, they don't shoot you one time and you bleed to death or your brains fly out or something like that. In prison, they stab you in the face 30 or 40 times. They're going to poke your eyeballs out. They want to roll you over and stab you in the spine to sever your spinal column. They want to get that homemade shank buried deep in your chest and cut open your aorta. You know, I mean, these are not like the television murders where they shoot a guy and he says, ow, ow, and he falls over and he dies. That's not what happens in prison, either for us or for the other inmates. I mean, I've seen inmates stab 15 times and it's not been fatal, but it looked like it really hurt.
Really?
And that's not the way they kill us.
Not like you're trying to, let that stuff happen. I mean, part of your job and just the surveillance, I would think, would be to do a count of the knives and forks and spoons in the cafeteria. And, they must have some control elements there, but these guys still, they're crafty. You know, they're in a prison situation where they could get killed too, so they're trying to make something to arm themselves. And in a situation, where somebody starts stabbing like that, I don't know how you could get to them before they hadn't stabbed 15, 20 times.
Well, the problem is it just takes seconds. An alarm goes off, and we might be there within 1 minute. But in 1 minute, you could stab a guy 40 times.
Wow. So
we might not be able to get you there. And I remember an incident. We had a little guy named Felix Delgado. He was a Cuban. This guy named Felix Delgado, this was in late of 89. I had just started there. You hear this explosion go off all over the prison. It could be heard almost from one end to the other. And I'm in the next unit over. I run out in the hallway. We're confused. Where is that sound from? What happened? Somebody comes out in the hallway and says, hey, it's down here in H unit. We run down to H unit. I go down to where they direct me to, and there's an inmate in a cell, and there is smoke all over the place. It's really smoky. And there's little bits of paper everywhere. And this Delgado fellow is holding his face, and there's blood just pouring out of his face between his fingers. He's obviously in distress. And I thought he must have been blind. I seen a piece of an eye, and he was in bad shape. And what happened was he had insulted somehow the Aryan Brotherhood or a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. So they sent one of their guys down there named Ted Patterson. And someone or him, I don't know who, has decided that they need to kill him. So he makes a bomb out of toilet paper, roll, axe heads, and a bunch of carbon paper, and then they scraped off a bunch of match heads, because way back then we allowed inmates to smoke and light their cigarettes with matches, and then a bunch of carbon paper, like he used in old typewriters to make a copy, and then a bunch of coffee creamer. They come in these little packages, and somehow in the certain formula that they had, they would make a pretty powerful bomb, and then in that they mixed a bunch of screws, bits of metal that they could find for shrapnel, and the guy, this Ted Patterson, walks by Delgado's cell, puts this thing up on his bars and says, hey, here's something for you, and walked away. And Delgado later told me that he walked up to it, wondered what it was, and he said he seen a wire sticking out of the back of it one instant before it exploded in his face. And put all these screws and things that flew into his head, ended up destroying one of his eyes, and the other one, the flash, the explosion damaged the other one, so he don't see too good anymore. And that's just what one of the A&Bs decided to do to him because they were disrespected and they couldn't put up with it.
Wow, that's some dangerous dudes there.
I mean, that's I hate to say that that's really ingenious, but
it is ingenious.
It is kind of, you know, kind of ingenious to sit there all day and just, you know, scraping down match heads.
God,
you got a book of matches? another one?
Yeah.
How many books of matches do you need?
That's, I mean, the kind of stuff David had to put up with on a day-to-day basis. That's amazing.
But he didn't kill the guy, so then the guy could testify against him, and the guy was already life in prison anyway.
Yeah, no. I don't know if he would have testified against him or not. I'm not sure of that, because I say it all the time. If you're not dead, it's because the A&Bs don't feel that you're worth killing.
Mm.
I think they could reach out and touch anybody, anywhere, in or out of prison.
Right.
So that's how dangerous as an organization they are.
I've heard that.
It could be for such, it's for silly things. This guy, the reason he got blown up was he refused to close the window. The guy's in the cell, and he says to this guy, hey, close that window over there. And he gave him some kind of lip about it and walked away. He didn't close the window. So a year or two later, he got a chance, and he got blown up for it.
Boy, that's a, that would be, that's a tough, that's a cruel, brutal world that you lived in for 23 years and went to work in every day. David, talking about prisoners hurting each other, that kind of is a nice segue into our famous mob boss, probably the most famous mob bosses of modern times, and name identification anyway, is John Gotti. Now, you were there when John Gotti first was assigned to the maximum security at Merriam. Is that correct?
I was there the very day that he rolled in the door. It was kind of memorable because I'd never seen anybody treated like him, not by us, by the other inmates. I was in the, it was I unit then, it's called special housing now. What you do is you come in, when you're transferred to the prison, you're brought into R&D, which is receiving and discharge, and they give you new clothes, they take your fingerprints, they give you mug shots, they give you the handbook that says all the rules, that kind of thing. And then from there, you're transferred down to the special housing unit until the unit staff, the paper pushers, figure out where it is that they want to put you. So for a couple of days, you sit down there. Well, when he just walked in the door, when he arrived down there, it was like, I don't know, the biggest celebrity known to mankind walked in there. Every inmate that could see him or hear him or knew that he could hear them pledged that they would do anything that he wanted. Do you need anything? Anything that I have, you can have. And he walked in there like this super celebrity guy, just kind of nodding his head. Yeah, okay, thank you, and I'll keep that in mind, and that sort of thing. And he went to his cell, and we put him in his cell, took the cuffs off of him. And for the rest of the evening, all you could hear was about how much I think you're a great guy and we love you. And it was just on and on like that. Later, he was still very well respected and everybody seemed to like him. But, you know, I didn't have to constantly hear about how I'll do anything for you from all the other inmates. I think the biggest incident that's known on the outside is when he was assaulted. Probably what got into his mind is that he was a big deal celebrity and nobody could do anything to him and he had the protection of the ABs. So he felt bulletproof that he could wander around, do anything, unlike some people that could be scared to tell you to stuff it and I'm not closing that window. This guy didn't feel that those rules applied to him. And I was told that up on C range, which is the upper part of the cell house, it's only an 18-inch wide little walkway. It's a little catwalk. And so if you and I were to meet going in opposite directions, I would have to kind of stand a little sideways, and so would you, so that we could pass each other. And there was an inmate up there named Walter Johnson, who, by the way, is the only inmate that I can ever remember being afraid of. He was a scary guy. He was a extremely muscled up black guy in his late 20s that had an explosive temper. I mean, maniacally explosive, just unbelievably angry individual. It's like he was just angry at everyone and everything all the time. Apparently, him and Dottie had some words when they had to pass each other. And, of course, Dottie doesn't feel that he needs to move aside or anything else. You need to get out of my way because I'm John Dottie. And this Walter Johnson didn't feel that he had to get out of the way. The next day, the day that I was at work, I end up getting, we're sitting around like we always do when we hear deuces. It's 222. You dial 222 on the phone and you report, hey, this is dog unit or easy. I don't remember which unit exactly. I think it was easy unit. We have a fight in easy unit. So I run to easy unit and, the number one's on the door. He opens it up and he tells me, go downstairs. I run downstairs and on the left hand side, which is the A range, I belly right up to the bars. And I see an inmate, a black inmate, which turns out later to be this Walter Johnson, striking somebody that's on the ground that I can't really see who he is. Other people have told me that they reviewed the tape, and there is a tape. I don't know where it is. I know it existed at one time because other people have reviewed it, that see this entire incident from beginning to end, probably even sees me in the video. I don't know what happened before. The unit staff told me that Dottie was just kind of walking around on the range like he always does, and this Johnson walked up behind him like he does, struck him in the back of the head, and Dottie's half beat up before he even knows he's in a altercation, and this Johnson just loses it and hits him repeatedly and kicking him and trying to knee him and bash his head on the floor, and of course then they call the deuces, and then I show up, and I see him strike this body that I can't tell who it is on the floor a couple of times. I yell at everybody, hey, we're going to open the door, and anybody that's not on the ground is going to be beaten up. I'm going to strike you with this. I got a 36-inch long riot baton with a metal ball on each end, and if I drive that into your ribs, you'll remember that for the rest of your life. And then we enter the thing, both Dottie and this Johnson lay on the ground. We end up cuffing them and taking them away. And I noticed that now I know it's Dottie because I can see him. And he's bleeding from the head because every little scratch on your head seems to bleed a lot. I thought he was hurt a lot worse than he was, but he just really had a good dent in his forehead. And that's pretty much, and a few scratches and stuff. I spoke to some of the people that, later after the fight, and God, he said that he had slipped and fallen, and that's how he got hurt. Even though they showed him the tape. Look, it's right here on the tape. He said, no, that's fake. I slipped and fell. Johnson, who's got a bunch of injuries on his hands where he was hitting Dottie, claims that one of us stomped on his hand, and that's how he got those injuries. But nobody was fighting as far as them two are concerned.
Case closed as far as they were concerned. Well, you got to admire Gotti. He was a stand up dude. He practiced Omerta right to the end of that. You got to admire a guy do that. Now there were other prisoners that were standing around. Nobody else jumped in or tried to help Gotti, I would understand you to say. Is that correct?
That's correct. I didn't see anybody assist anyone. It was, this is not my fight, and I'm backing away. And that's kind of what they did.
They didn't want to deal with Walter Johnson either.
Well, he must have been.
No, later, we ended up locking that guy up in G unit, which I eventually ended up working that unit when Walter Johnson was in there. And we put him way back in the back in 18 cell. And the reason we did that was because every time I entered that range that he was on, and I would turn to my coworker and say, so, how was fishing last weekend? And Johnson, way in the back, would start screaming, I know you're talking about me. I don't want you talking about me. I'm going to get out of here and kill you. And then he started jerking the solid door, because we had a solid door, and he would be yelling, and you could see the spit flying out of his mouth. And he would go into these complete berserk rages I told somebody one time, and it shocked the guy. I said, you know, I almost believe that guy could rip that door off the hinges, and if he does, I'm going to run.
Really?
My buddy said, well, I wouldn't run. I said, well, then you stay here and fight with a guy that can rip the steel door off.
And I'll run. You get your 36-inch baton out and see how that does against. Well, here, interestingly enough, I was looking up John Gotti, you know, from the Marion Prison. There's a link to John Gotti's Wikipedia page, and it says that the date of that was July 18th, 1996.
Yeah, it was the summer of 96, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Here it says that it was Gotti in the prison recreation room, leaving him bruised and bleeding because, according to the New York Daily News, Gotti had disrespected him, disrespected Walter Johnson, with a racial slur.
That could have been it. The staff said they didn't know.
Yeah,
at least the people that I spoke to said they didn't know. And it wasn't in a recreation room.
No.
I think I understand why they might say that, and I've heard that before, but that's not true. What we would do is we would open the cell doors, and we would let the inmates come out, but they were inside the unit. They didn't go anywhere. They were just inside the unit walking around on the ranges and stuff, and we called that recreation.
I see.
But it's not like they went to the yard or anywhere else.
There wasn't actually a rec room.
Yeah, he was on rec. Right. It wasn't actually a rec room. It was the actual unit itself.
Now, and then here it says that Gotti desired revenge, offering the Aryan Brotherhood, which you refer to as the AB, naming chieftains David Sahankin, I don't know if that's pronounced right, and Michael McElhaney.
David McElhaney.
Michael McElhaney. Somewhere between.
Yeah, it's Sahakian and McElhaney, yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. David Sahakian and Michael McElhaney, somewhere between $40,000 and $400,000 to have Johnson killed. Now, then it just goes further on, rather than read that, it says that ultimately it looks like Johnson was transferred to the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado.
Then
that's not true.
No?
That's not true. What happened was, is Johnson finished his federal sentence. First of all, we transferred him out. When he was in G unit, the rumor went out that Gotti's going to have him killed, and there's nothing we can do to protect this guy. He's going to get blown up. His cell's going to catch fire. Something's going to happen. So they got him out of Marion altogether. They transferred him out. And then Johnson finished his federal sentence. And I remember saying to one of my friends at the time, I said, that Walter Johnson guy is going to be some cop's nightmare. And I really didn't have any idea how true that was. What happened was he went to Washington, D.C. He jumped the turnstile because Walter Johnson don't have to pay for anything. He's Walter Johnson. And one of the employees, I guess, seen that, sent a cop over to write him a ticket or arrest him or something for jumping the turnstile at the underground. And Johnson, who worked out continuously all the time, this guy was like Superman. Out of all the people that I dealt with, he was the one that made me the most nervous, the one that I would admit that I was afraid of, and the only inmate that I was ever afraid of. Because he worked out all the time, and he had this explosive temper. He killed that police officer. He beat the guy senseless, took his firearm, and shot him in the head a couple of times, and he died. He then went to Philadelphia and was stopped on a traffic stop. He beats up three cops, tries to take one of their firearms, and an off-duty Philadelphia cop came over and knocked him down and got the firearm away from him before he murdered these three cops. Then he went back to federal prison, and he's now at the ADX serving time for the murdered D.C. police officer. So when they let him out, and I said, oh, yeah, he's going to be a nightmare for somebody, I had no clue how bad it was going to be.
Interesting. David, I'm curious. Do you have any idea what his crime was in the first place that landed him in Merriam?
Yeah, he was a bank robber.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. I was trying to figure out what kind of a federal crime just a street thug like that would do. You'd think he'd be in a state system, but being a bank robber, that would get him into the federal system. He was. I've met guys like that, and they're like so strong, and wrestled around with them on the street, and they're so strong with all your weight on one arm, you can't hardly control it. You'll have like three or four guys on them, you know, another guy on another arm, a couple of guys on their legs and their torso, and you still can barely control them. Those are not the kind of people you want to run into alone.
No, and I've hit people so hard with that 36-inch riot baton that I broke it. And I really think it wouldn't have bothered him a lot. I mean, he was just one of them kind of people. I fought inmates like that before, but they weren't that way to that extent. I mean, I'd hit them right in the forehead, and they kept coming.
Wow.
But Ted Johnson would have brushed me off like a fly.
Yeah,
he was that powerful. And he was able to beat up three cops at the same time with the weapons and the technique that they have. Wow.
Now,
so no wonder he kicked Gotti's butt, my point.
Let's go back to the AB a minute, just a little bit. Now, I believe you said before we actually went on there, we talked about this a little bit. Gotti did have some kind of relationship with the leaders of the AB at Merriam. Didn't you see them talking on occasion?
Oh, yeah, they would have, it looked to me, when I looked at it, I said, wow, there's a business meeting going on. Yeah, I would see him and Barry Mills and a guy named Tyler Bingham would sit down at lunch, and then they would have this intense discussion while eating lunch. I've seen that a few times. What I noticed after that, and I'm not sure if this was part of it or what, but I noticed that the Aryan Brotherhood changed about that time. They became less, at first, when I first started working, the Aryan Brotherhood was all about violence. They would do violence for the sake of violence. But after they had this contact with Gotti, and I think that he influenced them, but I have no proof. I can't tell you for sure. I just tell you what I observed. He was talking with the commission, which was the top three guys. And about that time, they seemed to change their business plan, if that's what you want to call it. It became more about, okay, we're going to have violence, and we're going to be just as violent of a person, of a group as we ever were, but we're going to target this violence to make more money. So if someone, like I was telling you before about they blew up a guy for merely not shutting a window, well, they would stop doing that, and they would blow up a guy because he welched on a business meeting, or he didn't come through with the promise that he said he would to make the money. Like, they wanted poison to poison people, and he didn't come up with the poison. He got blowed up. If you didn't close the window, they might let that slide. And I think Gotti took the techniques from the street and imparted that onto the Aryan Brotherhood. And that's just my opinion. I have nothing to back it up.
That would be more in keeping, or more like a mafia family, in that you always have that big hammer out there if you need to use it, and everybody knows you got that big hammer if you need to use it, but you don't use it except when it's absolutely necessary. In the course of business, it's all about making money. And it seemed like the ABs controlled a certain amount of the of drug activity, both inside and outside the penitentiary system.
I'd be surprised if they didn't control 100% of the drug trafficking inside prison walls. They either control it or they allow it, because there's no way that you're going to commit any crimes that they don't approve of. So, it's just not going to happen.
So they're really like the La Cosa Nostra, shall we say, of the prison system. If you've got any action going, then you're going to have to pay up to them just a little bit, or let them wet their beak, as they say in the olden days. Would that be correct?
Yeah. That's exactly the way it worked. Yes. And we even talked about it. It was like we were saying, well, these guys are like the inside mafia. And we thought that when Gotti and the commission was talking, we thought, well, and I believe it's true, that the mafia had contacts on the outside and could get things done, and the ABs had contacts and could get things done on the inside. So when Gotti ended up on the inside, the two melded together so that, hey, I'll do you a favor and you do me a favor. I need things done on the outside and you need things done on the inside.
Yeah, that would be pretty, that would come in handy. Like we had a mob guy in Kansas City that we were on his phone, and he got a call from a guy that was kind of a peripheral character. It was a businessman, really, a gambler. And his son had gotten some kind of trouble and was going to be sentenced to Leavenworth. And they knew it was coming up pretty quick. And this guy calls this mob guy, mob associate, and said, hey, he said, my son's going to be going to Leavenworth on this date. Can you, you know, arrange to make sure that he's got somebody to meet him, that everything's going to be okay? And the guy said, well, sure, I can take care of that. So that would be a pretty handy weapon to have if you're going to be involved with criminal activity, and especially in the federal system, to be able to make one call. And then when you come into the prison system, that you're welcomed in by the most powerful prison gang and protected by them. That would be huge.
Oh, yeah, that would be and the other way around would work, too. If you ever made them mad, there was nowhere in the federal system to hide. I mean, Mills could get people killed at Leavenworth just by putting out the word.
Now, here was something in the Wikipedia that's kind of interesting about John Gotti is, although here he is incarcerated as Supermax, right, in Merriam, Illinois, June 23rd, no, is that right, 23rd, 1992, sentenced both defendants to life imprisonment without possibility of parole. Here's John Gotti, the boss of New York. And he doesn't want to give up the role as that boss. At least that's what the Wikipedia is saying.
So did you see evidence of him trying to run the family while he was there in the penitentiary, having like an underling, an underboss coming and talking to him?
His son, John Jr., maybe stopping by?
Well, his family came and visited him, but those meetings are 100% monitored. He couldn't tell one of his family members to pass along a message that we wouldn't know about. It just wasn't possible.
Oh, it was
possible. The only way that he could communicate outside of our observation would be through a lawyer. And for all I know, his lawyers were crooked as hell. I don't know.
Well, I don't know about
that.
You were there and you would know something, but I know having talked with a number of different folks that were in the mob, Frank Calabrese Jr., one of those, that they talk in codes. Do you really know what they might be? Do you think they're talking about a couple of redheaded girls?
You know, they could have. It's a possibility. If they did, it wasn't in an obvious manner. We had a guy named Jeff Fort. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He ran the El Rukin.
Right, out of Chicago. And that was the biggest street gang in Chicago. I've heard of him.
He ran as many as 21 separate street gangs at the same time. He was that big a deal. If you want to talk about organized crime, Jeff Fort is a good example of non-mafia organized crime. I mean, he is still a big, big name in the Chicago area, and he did communicate in code. And it was extremely obvious that he was communicating in code. There was no way that we had to translate his code until I eventually got a turncoat from his organization who was able to translate it for us. But you could listen to him talk, and you know that what he's saying has nothing to do with what he's communicating, but you couldn't prove it. It was just, he would just be very obvious. And they'd make a big deal out of a single word. No, he would say something about, he's a vagabond. That was my favorite word that he would use. He's a vagabond. And they would say, he's a vagabond? Yes, you heard me. Vagabond. He is a vagabond. And then they would discuss this one simple word for 2 or 3 minutes, and then they would move on. And I don't have no clue what it was he was telling them, but it was very important.
Interesting, yeah.
Well, he did that.
That Calabrese Jr. and his dad and some other people, they've got some audio of them talking in the visiting room, and Calabrese Jr. actually interpreted a little bit of it for us, like a curly-headed little girl was a particular guy that they were talking about, and had a variety of little code words, and if you were just to listen to it, you had no idea what it was without the context.
We had a fellow that worked in the SIS office, and he pretty much specialized in the Italian mafia. And we had another one that specialized in Mexican mafias and that sort of thing. But this guy was a self-taught mafia intelligence officer, and I know that he was translating some of that stuff. We have actually had an FBI agent assigned to Marion, and I'm not sure what his duties were in its entirety, but I know at least partially his duties were to pass on intelligence that they picked up from the Italian mafia. And this fellow that I'm talking about that worked in the SIS office, that was kind of what he was doing, was picking apart their correspondence and their any communication they had. That was what he did. I didn't have anything to do with it. I knew the fellow, and he's a very bright fellow, but he felt that he didn't need to talk to me about anything he was doing.
Yeah. It's a constant battle of wits in that penitentiary system between the law enforcement, whether it be the guards or like that, an FBI agent assigned to Miriam, and a constant battle of wits for the prisoners to get away with stuff and hide it, and for the correctional officers to uncover it and keep things rolling along and as best that you can. And some of those guys like Mac and Gotti, you know, these are really bright people. These aren't your booger-eating morons that many times will end up in the lower ends of crime that are in the state system. You got some of the brighter guys committing crimes in the United States that you got to match wits with.
I don't know if I'm complimenting or not, but Mac was a lot smarter than Gotti. I mean, Gotti was intelligent. He really knew how to organize things and get it to run. But for sheer intelligence and a pain in my neck, it was Mac.
Mac
was,
McNally.
Martin J. McNally, if you're listening, that probably is a point of honor,
yeah,
actually.
Mac, I know you'd like to hear that.
I was going to ask you, I know when we talked with you last week that you said that they had a special room where they could go and they had a typewriter and some pencils and paper and some books. I was curious if that typewriter had the cap locks key stuck in all caps, because whenever Martin posts up comments and communicates, it's always in all caps.
No, but, you know, I have seen a couple of other places that he has made like a comment on something, and he does that all the time.
He always does it in all caps.
I didn't know if that was just because that was his, you know, like if that was a style or that was the equipment, or maybe when you do motions and filings, you want it to, you know, be very legible, so you put it all in caps.
Yeah, no, it's just a quirk of him. And
yeah.
It makes me, I've seen him make a comment somewhere else, and then I've seen some idiot on the internet say, oh, this is fake, and you're a bull. And I'm like, no, I know that style, and I know the way that he talks, and that's him. That's really, truly him. And it's this moron on the internet saying that everything he's telling him is fake, and it's not true.
Well, you might go back.
Wow, you people don't trust anyone.
You might go back, and we did two original episodes where we talked about D.B. Cooper, and more specifically about the copycats, and then we had more information at the time about Martin J. McNally, and so talked with him at length, and if you go and look in the comment section on those two, he literally commented, and then an hour later commented again after he listened to the second.
He said, we didn't know what we were talking about.
Uh-huh. We were,
and he would be happy to straighten us out. So he straightened us out, and we interviewed him directly. So that was.
But he did say we were hilarious.
Yeah, he thought we were funny.
But we got a lot of facts wrong.
Yeah. Well, we never let the facts get in the way of a good story,
yeah.
Do we, Aaron?
No. Well, as long as we can speak of facts, you know, John Gotti didn't stay in Miriam until he died. And in fact, he was diagnosed with throat cancer in 1998. And here it says, according to Wikipedia, sent to the United States Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri for surgery.
Yeah, he died in Springfield, Missouri. And I've seen a bunch of stuff where people swear he died in Marion, and that is not true. A matter of fact, the warden that was over Springfield was the same warden that we used to have. So they had that warden had a long contact with him. As a matter of fact, he got throat cancer or mouth cancer, and we, the staff, was teasing our dentist, because we only had one dentist at USP Marion, and the rumor went around that it was because Gotti didn't have the proper maintenance on his fake teeth. He had implants and some other dental work, and so rumor went around that it was because he didn't have this proper maintenance that perhaps it went a little bit toward advancing his cancer. So we would tease the dentist and say, "Hey, did you see any big long black limos when you went home today in your rearview mirror?"
Little gallows, little prison humor there, right. Little gallows humor among the staff and the Miriam.
Were you followed by a stolen car with a couple of shady characters in it? Did they ask you to get in the passenger front seat?
Yeah. Did he have his wife go out and start his car each morning?
Yeah, the mailman. Yeah, we were doing that. Do you look under your car for wires and things? And if the mailman's wearing a white tie, you might not want to open the door.
Yeah, really wearing a sharkskin suit and a white tie, don't open the door. And a fedora hat and alligator shoes. A
pair of Sansibel slacks.
Yeah, and in Kansas City, a pair of Sansibel slacks, a polo shirt, and a brown leather coat and a snap-brim hat.
And clear nail polish on some really finely manicured nails.
You're right. Well, this has been great.
The dentist didn't have a sense of humor about that.
I bet he
did. He didn't appreciate that.
This has been great. You know what? What we ought to do is we ought to get you to come back and tell stories again if you want to.
Yeah, I never even told you the one where I burned up Gotti's food.
Oh, that's right. Let's do that. Let's do that one before we get out of here. Tell us the story about burning up Gotti's food.
Some genius came up with this idea of having a premium meal, a premium entree, and sell it in the commissary. And it was $5 or $6. It was very expensive for inmates who don't have money like that. Well, that wasn't a problem for Gotti. He had all the money that he could spend. He would spend the limit. He decided that he was going to get one of these premium entrees. To get it properly prepared, it had to be cooked in a microwave. And all the other prisoners had enough sense to know that ain't no guard gonna cook nothing for you. So we had the attitude of, look, we're here to take care of you, to make sure that you have everything you're supposed to have, but I'm not your servant. I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not working in a restaurant here. Gotti walked up to me and he plopped one of these premium entrees, which was some kind of a hamburger piece of meat thing. And he said, "I want you to cook this for me." And I said, "Sure, no problem. Hand it over." So I put it in the microwave, and this microwave, I've never seen one like it before. It's 220 volts, and I don't know how many watts this thing sucks, but when it turns on, you're supposed to cook 6 meals in it at a time. It heats 6 meals. So I put this little bitty tray with a piece of meat in there about the size of my hand, and I gave it a flip over to 7, 8, 10 minutes, like that. And then I went to the bathroom.
Oh, God.
Of course, it wasn't in the room where he was at. He could just look at it as it was cooking away in the microwave.
Yeah. It's about 10 feet from him. He can see it, and he can't do anything about it. And it's just there cooking away.
You're cold, man. I walked away.
So I go in the bathroom, and I'm in there, and I use the bathroom. And I can hear him out there yelling, Hey, officer, you know, I'm doing my thing, and I wash my hands, and I make sure that my tie is straight, and I look down and polish my shoes a little bit, and then I have to go over to see the number one on the other side and ask him how he's doing and everything. The whole time I'm hearing, hey, you better come over here, you know, after about 10 minutes, I went over there, and I opened it up, and there was this hockey puck thing with a bunch of plastic melted around it.
Oh, God.
And it's smoking. And I push it out with a paper towel. And I said, "Oh, crap. I seem to have overcooked this." And I put it up on the thing. I go, "Well, here it is." And he goes, "That's ruined." And I said, "Well, go get another one." And he just grabbed it and walked away and never said it again. He was a...
So those stories that we saw in, for example, the Goodfellas movie where all the mob guys have this big kind of nicer cell and they bring in, they have a hot plate and they cook spaghetti and they make sauce and they have, prosciutto, ham and all the delicacies. That's not really true is what I hear you saying.
Not at Marion. At Marion, everybody gets the same thing that everybody else gets, and you don't get anything more or anything less. Gotti was just another inmate in my cell house.
You didn't think to maybe just, you know, go ahead and spring that $5 for that meal that you burned up just so he wouldn't be mad at you?
Apparently
you didn't
not.
Have to look over your shoulder?
I was making a point, and my point is, you know, I sit here, I do what I do, and you do what you do, but don't ask me for any favors, and I won't ask you for any favors.
Right.
And that's the way we operated.
But there were
there was a line that I didn't cross, and they didn't cross, and that was crossing the line.
You were setting boundaries, as they say in the recovery or the therapy business. You were setting good boundaries.
Yes. That's exactly what it was. I didn't ask you for a favor. Don't ask me for one.
But it's not possible that Gotti, yeah. I mean, in who he is and everything, there weren't guards there that maybe wouldn't overcook his food? He just learned not to ask you.
No, I don't really think that, I don't know of the guy that would have, because let's say that somebody else did, if my number one did, I would have went and told on him.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been the pariah.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been, oh, so you're a little suck-up, are you? You want to suck up to the inmate? Are you one of them? Are you on their side? No, there was, and that was the thing about Marion as opposed to anywhere else. There was so many of us, and we worked so closely together that if I did something cowardly, it would have spread everywhere. It's like that guy that told me, hey, when I said, hey, if that guy could rip off that steel door and get to us, I'm going to run.
Yeah.
He said he would stand there and fight. And the reason he said that was he's not a coward. He's never going to show being a coward, and he'll stand and die before he crosses that line. That was his point. He actually poured into me for, how dare you say you would run? I'm like, it's in the face of certain death.
Really?
And he said, doesn't matter.
Well, I don't know about the prison correctional officers and guards, but on the police department, when you're young and you're new, you're like that. When you get to be an old-timer, and you then know when to walk away.
Yeah.
And a guy needs to know when to walk away. The young guys need to don't know when to walk away. We, as an older sergeant, I tell these young guys, you know, you can't be doing that stuff by yourself. You need to make sure you got help. And he'd say, well, what about this guy or what about that guy? And said, you know, that guy knows when to back down and ask for help. You don't. So it sounds like you ran into one of those situations.
Yeah, it probably was like that.
And yet none of the other guards came back at you and or the dentist and said, you know, remember that microwave meal that you burned up? I think John ate that. Maybe you gave him throat cancer.
Oh, no, the only thing that when we talk about stuff like that, they'll say, oh, yeah, here's the dude that burned up Gotti's stuff. Remember that? They all bust out laughing.
Well, it's good to hear that law enforcement is the same all over.
I've noticed there's two different ways of looking at that story. All the law enforcement bust out laughing. That's pretty good. That's funny.
Yeah.
And then the people that like the mafia, they're like, oh, you're evil and bad and something horrible should happen to you.
The little mob fans. I watch them on Facebook. I'll put something up about one of these guys that's gone into witness protection and come out and written a book, and I've interviewed him, and I'll put something up about him, and people start putting up they're a rat and they're this and they're that, and every once in a while one of them will come back and just lay into him, you know. So it's mainly the little fanboys out there that wannabes want to think that they, but they only do it on the internet, I've noticed.
Well, you have had family members comment too.
Who, me?
Haven't you?
Yeah, half-assed family members comment from Kansas City. They're never blood family. They've always been, when I've looked into it, people made negative comments about something I've said about one of these mob guys in Kansas City. They've always ended up being some kind of step. They'll find out they claim to be a stepchild or a stepbrother or a step this or step that of the person I was talking about. So, and they've never done anything more than the internet, which is as far as they're ever going to go.
No.
Well,
Gotti had a couple of those people. We had some lady that showed up one day claiming to be his daughter, and she was just a nut.
Yeah.
And they ended up ejecting her, and the Marion Police Department called us a couple of times about her, and it was like, no, she's no relative at all. She's a nut. She actually had her name legally changed.
Gotti. That did surprise
me. Wow. He
draws him. He really, that name draws him.
Well, I mean, why wouldn't you change your name legally to Gotti if you could maybe get into the, you know, the visitor center at Merriam and get an hour with John.
Go talk to John.
I might do that.
I wouldn't.
Well, I'd do that for us.
Well,
I could legally have a change back.
That's precisely what she did. She showed up. She showed up saying, "Hey, I'm his daughter. Here's my ID." And, you know, she don't show up on anything because you have to be approved and you have to be investigated and all that. And it's like, we don't know who this person is. And it turned out, oh, no, she's a nut.
She probably shows up on Facebook trying to pretend like she's a Gotti family member. You see stuff like that on the in the different mobs pages where people will claim to be a relative and then somebody else will start getting suspicious about it. And pretty soon they're being exposed. We had somebody that claimed to be a Capone great niece or something, and finally it came out that it was just some nut. Somebody tried to pretend like they were. That's kind of common in that world. All right, Aaron, you got anything else? Yeah. Any other Gotti stories? Wait a minute, before we stop, you got any other Gotti stories?
No, I kind of think that I'm Gottied out.
You're Gottied out.
I'm pretty sure I've told you about all my songs.
Well, good.
That's wait a minute. No. Oh. One just occurred to me.
Okay.
He used to get a lot of mail. John Gotti got as much mail as the rest of the cell house combined.
Oh, really?
He used to get, he got a whole duffel bag every day, 5 days a week, of fan mail. And he wouldn't read almost any of it. Every now and then he'd read a little, but not most of it. And I worked with this gal who just started working. It's just when we first started allowing women to work in Marion. For a long time, we were male only. Nobody behind the certain grill could be female. And matter of fact, I'm the second smallest guy they ever hired up to that point. I'm 5'9", and I'm the second shortest person they had working there. The little guy that was 5'8", and everybody else is like a lot larger than I am, and including most of the secretaries that were ladies are bigger than me. So. I'm one of the smallest people that ever worked there. And anyway, this girl that started working there, this lady that started working there, she would read Gotti's incoming mail from all these people. And she would show me these photographs of like women that had no clothes on except they're holding their hands over certain strategic parts. And it would say things like, "I was hoping you would write me back," you know, crazy stuff like that.
Yeah.
You mean like their face?
Gotti used to get this. Yeah, their face.
That would be a real strategic part in some for some ladies, but go ahead.
Yeah. And some fellas would write in, and it was just insane. It was like, here's all the crimes that I committed, and he would have the left side. These are the ones I got arrested for. And on the right side, it would say, and these are the ones that cops haven't caught me at. And it was like, wow. Like, we're gonna make a photocopy of this and send it to your chief of police, dumbass.
Did you do that?
Take those crimes off the right-hand side and put them over on the left because they just been solved.
They just got solved thanks to the correctional officers at the USP Marion.
So I used to read some of these letters because this gal got me started on it. She was like, "Hey, look at this letter." You know, yeah. He used to get some really humorous stuff. The guys that would, and there were several of them that would apply for a position with the mafia. And then there was all these women that would write and say all kinds of, you know, "I love you," and "Here's a picture of me naked," and you know, it's like, okay. And he didn't read them. He would just get the ones for his relatives or people that he knew and just hand the bag out to all the other thugs, and then they would write people. And a bunch of them would write and say that they were him.
That's funny.
But the ones from the actual family members? They would be like, "How's the weather? You know, we noticed that we had a number of sandwiches that were missing." And you're like, "Sandwiches?" Because they were writing in code.
I think John Gotti slipped kind of out of the mainstream of running anything pretty quickly after he got there. It was pretty hard. His son was trying to do it, and I think he kind of, then he got sick, but I think he slipped out of the mainstream of really running anything.
Here it says in the Wikipedia that Peter Gotti subsequently became the acting boss and is believed to have formally succeeded his brother shortly before Gotti's death.
Yeah. It's the thing about a mafia family. They are, and I've heard this said before, it's not like a lot of crime families or crime organizations, you'll have one charismatic head leader. And if you take out the leader, then everybody else just kind of fritters away. They're structured as such, and like almost like the military. They're based on the really the Roman legions, where you would have a boss, an underboss, a counselor, and then crews with crew leaders. And then a crew leader would even have a guy who's kind of like his lieutenant in each crew. So you always had somebody to move on up whenever you took. Whenever law enforcement took somebody out or somebody got killed, kind of self-perpetuating.
Well, that was at Jeff Fort, and that was why he was so successful. That's exactly the way he ran his place. It was it sounded to me just like the Army. They had captains, lieutenants, sergeants. When you spoke to Jeff Fort, it was, sir, yes, sir. And that's exactly the way they speak. Even if it's in code, it's always, sir, yes, sir. They were very disciplined like an Army. And they made it very obvious.
Interesting. So the El Rucans, you know, I know they were this huge, big street gang that of course had narcotics operations going in Chicago, and Chicago is that is a street gang capital of the United States. Now, did the El Rucans, did they get enough of them in the prison that they could kind of have their own presence felt as a gang?
No, and they did that on purpose. They isolated Fort from everybody that could have offered him any assistance. And that was on purpose.
Because he was
they kept his people away.
Yeah, he was such a charismatic.
Even if they were in our prison, even if they were in our prison, they weren't in that same cell block.
I see.
So they isolated. That would be the purpose of that that fishing line going from one cell block to another, so that they can communicate.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a battle of wits constantly.
Well, it's worth mentioning again is John Gotti's, he died of throat cancer. Here it says in June 10th of 2002 at the age of 61 years old.
And he didn't live.
Yeah, he left us in 2001. Mm. So I don't know how many months he was gone prior to his death, but it was several months after he left us is when he died.
Did he get in ill health while he was still there, where he was weakened and had a lot of symptoms of this throat cancer?
I noticed him getting thinner.
Yeah.
But he was the kind of fellow that he would have never, I think he would have cut off his leg, and he would have told me that he nicked himself shaving, and I'm lying, and it's not true, and covered it up. He would never admit to anything.
He was a stand-up
the only person
guy.
That I know that was worse than that.
Who's that? Well,
the only one that I knew that was worse than that was a guy named Mickey Scarfo. He was a mafia guy out of Philly. And that Mickey Scarfo, I could ask him what color the wall was, and I think I did it one time just to be a smart ass.
Yeah.
And he told me, well, it depends. I'm not really sure. It depends on what you call it. He never gave me a straight answer to any question I ever asked.
Yeah, he was.
It was just the way he was. But he wasn't disrespectful.
Yeah.
He just would never answer your question. Well, even after I burned up Gotti's food, he was never disrespectful to me. But he wouldn't answer. He wouldn't communicate. He just, you can tell I don't like you, and that's the way it is.
Yeah. And he sure never asked you to cook his food again, did he? Or anybody, the other correctional officer?
Nobody ever had that side of the cell house asked to cook food from me, and he never asked from anybody else. Yeah, he took that special meal and returned it.
Well, so 23 years, when did you end up rolling out of Marion?
Are you saying when? What year I left?
Yeah.
2012.
You've been retired.
I left on
6 years.
Yeah, five and a half, six, something like that. Yeah, an inmate and me ended up having an altercation in the hallway, and we ended up in a fist fight in the hallway. So they made a big deal out of it. Oh my God, that David guy beating up inmates, and they made a big deal. So I said, you know what? I've had it. I'm an old man. I don't need this crap anymore. I am out of here. That evening, when I came home, I had made a decision to retire the next day. We called the limo people, and at the end of the next day, I left the place in a limo. The captain freaked out. You can't retire without a notice. I said, okay, but on the 28th, you better have somebody to replace me.
Well, after 23 years, and there you are, you're still working the job, you're on the floor, and here's a guy you get in a fight with. There's got to be some level of where you're like, you know, maybe I'd just rather take my retirement because I can spend it alive.
Really?
Because you're always looking over your shoulder.
That's what happened with that Hoffman and Klutz. One of those guys was past his retirement date, and he got murdered. And we've all talked about it. And, you know, I got in that fist fight, and I was thinking back to those fellows in 83 that died past their retirement. And I said, you know what? Time to cash in the chips. I need to leave this table. I've gotten all I'm going to get.
Really? I understand. I understand.
You could live to tell some stories, which folks can now hear from the mouth of the men that did it.
Really, these are great stories. And folks, if you want to hear even more of these stories, you need to go out to YouTube and just search for As the Key Turns, and you will find these stories and a whole bunch more. How many do you have? Do you know, David, for sure?
There's 60 now, and I'll have more. I keep making more. I can keep you on this phone for days, so we'll have to call it eventually quit.
Yeah. All right. We're about done. You got any last questions there, Aaron? Aaron's shaking his head no.
Well, I mean, what are you doing June 15th, 16th, and 17th? Happen to be out in Vegas. You could hang out with Gary Jenkins and myself at the Mob World Summit.
And we're doing it's kind of an author event, a bunch of different guys that have written my books, or I've got a book and a documentary, and going out there, and we'll have panel sessions all day long. The Saturday night, we're going to go to the Mob Museum, and we've got a set up there where we have a room there to do some more, another panel group, or I think he has a kind of a keynote speaker, the guy that really put this together, and then we'll have time to go through the Mob Museum. And then Sunday we'll do panel sessions at the Plaza Hotel downtown from 9 to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you happen to be in Las Vegas on June 15th, 16th, and 17th, why come to the Plaza Hotel and sit in with us?
I will, yeah. Let me see what my schedule looks like.
All right. That would be cool. All right, Aaron, you got anything? I think we're done. Well, David, this has been great. Great stories, David. I really appreciate you calling in and letting us interview you.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. Goodbye, David.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was a first, really, for us here. I mean, we've talked with federal agents. We've talked with, you know, sheriff's department, you know, officers. We've talked with police officers. We've talked with criminals and, you know, drug kingpins, if you will. And never having spoke actually with somebody who had to work the beat inside those prison walls.
I know. That was great. I'm glad I stumbled across his YouTube site. He's really got some good stories in there. And he's got a lot of really good stories, too. That's the first time I've ever heard a real direct insider's account of that fight that Gotti got into and those other things that went on in the penitentiary with Gotti. There's a lot of speculation out there. There's a lot of people that think they know these stories, but this guy knows them. He was right there. He was like the second guy at the scene when the fight was still going on when he got there.
Right. Here's a guy's got, well, I would want to pull this guy off of whoever he's beating up, but I already know that Walter Johnson's a bad dude.
And he's going to beat me up, too.
Right? This is not going to be easy.
Really. Well, Gotti seemed to survive that okay. You know, it's kind of interesting that he fell in with the most powerful prison gang in the United States, the Aryan Brotherhood, and this guy David used to sit and watch them almost have business meetings every day at lunchtime. So that's another little insider fact I've never seen. I've done a lot of reading on the mob and a lot of reading blogs and books and that kind of thing, and watching the mob Facebook pages and seeing people share stuff, and I've never heard of that one before. So this has been a great interview. Plus the insider stuff about our good friend Martin McNally in the first segment of this two-parter.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, what we hear a lot of and you read a lot of is how these mob figures get busted, they get incarcerated, and somehow, not just in Marion, but in other prison systems, they still seem to be able to run and operate their organized criminal endeavors.
Well, I don't think they got it done at Merriam.
He gets like 1 hour a day to get right out on the rec room as they called the level that was really just where all the cells were at.
Yeah, and they let them out together, but they have these ingenious methods of communicating with each other with stringing a piece of what was it?
Fishing line
from one cell to the other, and then they could run a message from one cell to the other, and because communication, if you're going to run an organization, you have to be able to communicate with people. Otherwise, there's no way to run any kind of an organization. You just operate on your own. So that's they're ingenious. And Mac was really, I thought was interesting about what he said about Mac is the guy that can figure out the nuts and bolts of doing something. He's not the grand boss or the entrepreneur that you know puts everything together. But once he gets an idea, he's the one that can carry it out. Where a lot of people have big ideas, but they lack on execution. Mac can execute because he knows how to figure stuff out. Plus that jailhouse lawyer thing. I knew we had talked about some of that. He's got a couple cases he's working on now. He even actually got hold of me after the Boonie Hat Bandit segment and had some ideas on helping him. But then I had to tell him he didn't realize. He thought he was in the federal system, and he didn't realize he was in the state system.
Yeah, that he'd already served his federal time.
He'd already served his federal time, so he was kind of at a loss after that. But he's always willing to help. He's working on a guy now up in Alaska that is, I think, wrongfully incarcerated. God, I can't remember that guy's name. I'll put it in my show notes.
Well, you know, he's got to be a sharp guy, you know, Martin J. McNally, to get out in 2010.
Yeah,
when
really?
I don't know if it was 72 or 2072 or 2082 or
something. Well, something 2078. He had two life terms.
Yeah, there was so much time that he would have been like 120 or 140 when he got out. It was if he's in his 70s right now. So, you know, this is a guy who, you know, was looking at spending his entire life in prison and was able to turn that around and get out. And you know, obviously, as David said, as a guard from Marion, there's not a lot of recidivism.
Not out of that one. There's not very few people to even get out, I think, at that point in time.
Mac being one of them.
Yeah, and he got out, and he's staying out, and he seems to be thriving. I think he's doing okay, and I don't foresee him ever going back. I think he's a sharp enough
guy. He could have done anything on the outside in a straight man's job.
Right. He is one sharp dude. So, all right, Aaron, I think we ought to do the public service announcement now. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rent or purchase on Amazon. And then after you get done watching that, you're probably going to want to know a little bit more. And there's a lot more to know. And Gary's the man to tell you about it with his book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
You can get that and read it, and it's a great read, but it's an even better Kindle because the Kindle has hyperlinks to video with the actual audio with transcription from the mouth of the men that did it. So interesting, all of these stories that these gentlemen tell, that you're going to want to come to Kansas City, and when you do, you're going to want to get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
I'd say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music. Yo.